The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Welcome, welcome. Jim, I'm sorry, can we put the volume up just a tiny, tiny bit so that it can be a little bit easier and I don't have to put my voice. Thank you. Thank you. So I'd like to start the talk this evening with a little story, very short story, that we find in the suttas. I'm modifying it just a little bit. So imagine that there's a hungry dog, a dog that's hungry, not so unusual, and it finds a bone. It's all excited. But this bone has been outside for quite some time. It's sun bleached. Doesn't have much nourishment left in it. Doesn't have any marrow. Doesn't have any meat. But it looks like a bone. It smells like a bone. So the dog starts to chew on it. Of course. Like, why not? Especially if you're hungry, right? Starts to chew on it. There's something promising in this bone. And he discovers that, oh, there's actually no meat here. There's no marrow here. He's disappointed. And he turns away and goes to whatever he's going to do next. It seems obvious. It seems uncomplicated. It seems pretty straightforward. This idea that here's this dog who has this idea, he was at hunger, and the hunger would be relieved by with this bone, tried to get hunger relieved, discovered it didn't work, turned away and went to do something else. It didn't leave the bone because the bone was bad. And it didn't turn away because it decided, oh, I shouldn't be hungry. Or anything like this. It was just this natural recognition that the bone couldn't provide what it wanted or what it needed. And so this is one way in which we can understand this idea, this concept, this teaching in the early Buddhist literature about disenchantment. So disenchantment is not of turning away because it's saying like, oh, you shouldn't have any desire for anything. You shouldn't want anything. And it's not saying that objects out there are bad or evil or, you know, in some kind of way. It's just saying that there's a natural turning away when we discover that objects and experiences can't give us what we're really looking for, what we're hungry for. And so as humans, we have this hunger too. We have literal hunger for food and nourishment. But often we have this other hunger that maybe isn't named. Maybe we don't recognize it so clearly what it is. Maybe it's obvious. This idea for a sense of peace. A sense of belonging. A sense of safety. Maybe love. These are things that human beings are looking for. Of course they are. These are natural things to be expected. This idea of maybe having some well-being or just being at home in our life. And so having these wishes, having these desires, these are not character flaws. These are not problems. They're not signs of, you know, bad practice. We might have this idea. Sometimes we have this idea that, okay, we should be you know, immune to anything, or we should be disconnected, we should be detached. That's not what this Buddhist practice is pointing to. This is not what it's about. But instead, can we have some compassion for the human condition, that we're looking for these things, safety, well-being, love, belonging, peace? The list can be long. Maybe for you, there's some of these that I'm saying resonate more than others. And so what we often don't recognize is that underneath some of our desires, there's a deeper wish. We might not be so in tune with what these deeper wishes are, but of course we might have this wish for approval. Of course we do. We don't want to be having our actions in the world or our relationships be met with disapproval after disapproval after disapproval. Of course we don't. But sometimes what we don't see is that underneath this kind of this wish for approval is this idea of, well, I want to feel like I'm okay. And I'm okay, that can mean so many different things. Or maybe there's this way in which we want to feel like we have a little bit more control over things. I want to make this happen and make that other thing stop happening. Make those people over there behave differently. Make myself behave differently. We're just trying to control things. And maybe underneath that, there's this deeper wish of wanting to feel safe. If I can control things, then I'll be safe. Or maybe there's a way in which we want some success, however we define success. That definition will be different for different people. And maybe underneath that is this deeper wish. I want to feel like complete. I want to feel like satisfied. I want to feel like I'm enough. And so we go out there trying to find these things. So the problem is not that we're looking for these things, feeling like we're okay, or I'm enough, or feeling safe, something like this. The problem is when we are looking to satisfy our hunger, so to speak, in places that can't provide it. They just can't. But we keep on looking. Of course we do. Of course we do. And so this suffering ensues when we keep on looking, and maybe a little bit like this dog is like gnawing on the bone, thinking like, it looks like a bone. It smells like a bone. Usually these things are helpful, but it's not. We have these expectations, and then we discover, oh yeah, this actually isn't satisfying. And so the dissatisfaction, this repeated dissatisfaction, is dukkha, this suffering, the first noble truth that there is dukkha. And I'm using this single word suffering to stand for really terrible experiences and really just minor, like, yeah, it doesn't feel very good, but that's okay. I'll just go watch a movie, Netflix, another Netflix thing or something like that. So there's this way, and when we might be looking for nourishment in these places where it can't be found. I know that I had this experience when I, there was a time when I was working in corporate America, working my way up the corporate ladder. I had a certain amount of professional success. Actually, I had a great job. I had an enviable job. I had a job that was really was in my field, took advantage of my training, took advantage of my experience. I had respect of my peers. I had a lot of autonomy. my department. I felt like it was a good department. I worked for a company. I felt like we were doing good work in the world. We were making difference in people's lives in a really good way. I felt proud to work there, to do this work. I felt like, wow, I have this great job at plenty of money, or earning and what I felt like was enough money. And felt like, okay, I have this professional success. But I don't feel quite happy, satisfied in the way that I thought that I would. I felt like, okay, I had followed all the rules. I had like done what was expected and felt like, yeah, it doesn't feel quite right. I don't feel as satisfied as I expected to. And I felt like I can't find what to, this hunger, quote unquote, what this seeking. I couldn't determine like what would be satisfying because I was so busy working. And so my life situation allowed me to stop working and go on a meditation retreat, which ended up changing my life. I never in a million years would think that I'd be sitting here giving a Dharma talk. I was trained as a scientist, right? That's kind of like the opposite direction. And so there's this way in which we discover that, okay, even if we are finding what we think is going to, I don't know, maybe like scratch that itch or put the end to all the seeking, a way in which we can finally rest. If like, oh, okay, I finally made it. But it doesn't happen. I don't know if I've met anybody. Well, there's a huge selection bias, right? Because the people that I talk to are the people that meditate. And if you have all your dreams coming true, you're not going to a meditation center. You're just out there living your dream life, right? You're not going on retreats. You're not talking to a meditation teacher. You're out there making the world a better place. So you're doing whatever it is you're doing, right? So the people that I see and talk to, of course, in this role are the ones that are like me. I found like, yeah, something isn't quite right. It's not enough. I don't know if we would consider ourselves like a dog with a bone. Maybe there's something kind of unflattering about this, but I bring it because it's in the suttas. This is something in the early Buddhist literature that the Buddha is pointing to, this experience. So there's this way in which not only is it this suffering of not finding what we're looking, and then we just keep on seeking. And often, you know, the first decades or we do this, like, okay, it's not a problem. That relationship, well, that one didn't work out. The next one will. Oh yeah, that job wasn't quite right. The next one will. Oh yeah, that friend. Yeah, that wasn't the best. Then the other friends will, or that house, that apartment, that city, that one wasn't right. The next one will, right? That we're doing this. And there comes a time when we realize, is this ever going to end? This seeking? So there's this way this seeking is itself has this exhaustion. So not only is it uncomfortable to always be looking, but there's a way it takes energy. It takes our life energy to seek completion, we might say, in things that can't complete us. And so this idea of disenchantment, it's not that things out there in the world are bad or unhelpful or no good or anything like that. That's not the teaching. Life is life. There's so much beauty and joy and happiness for us to experience, participate in. The problem is when we're expecting life to give us something that it can't give. That's the problem. There's no need to turn away from the joy and the happiness, right? Many of you know these are like integral parts of the path of practice. Happiness, joy is factors of awakening. But there's this way in which We might be looking for this permanent or steady sense of well-being, but things change. There is nothing that's permanent in the way that we want it to be. We want this lasting happiness. We want this reliable, steady happiness. Of course we do. But the world can't give us reliable, steady happiness because the world is not reliable and steady. So a question we can ask when we find ourselves having some of this difficulty, this suffering, is when this seeking is, what am I hoping to find here? Is this actually nourishing? And I kind of like this word, nourishing. If this word doesn't resonate with you, you're welcome to find another word. But for me, nourishing kind of feels like then you feel like sated in some kind of way. Like there's a feeling like, for me, it's when you have warm soup on a cold day. And there's this way, like the warm soup just feels, ah. But this way in which we want to have this continuously or always. So the question we can ask is, what am I hoping to find here in this experience, in this object? Is it nourishing? Is it supportive in the way that I really want it to be? So this idea of disenchantment, the Pali word is nibbida. It comes from these two prefixes, nis, which means not, and vindati, which is finding, not finding. Often gets translated as disenchantment, not finding. Sometimes it gets translated as disillusionment. Sometimes it gets translated as revulsion, disgust. Those tend to be a little bit older translations. Now more modern ones are kind of using disenchantment and disillusion. But I love this idea of disenchantment because it implies that we were enchanted, that we were under the spell. We thought that something was going to make us feel better in a way that was really satisfying. So it's not that things don't bring joy or happiness or pleasure. If that can be a trap, though, if we're always looking after pleasure. Pleasure and happiness are not the same thing. Pleasure and joy are not the same thing. That's a whole other Dharma talk that I can give. But this idea that this disenchantment, it's not that we don't find anything. It's that we don't find the nourishment. It's that we don't find the refuge. Because the Dharma, this practice, is not asking us to deny beauty or to deny goodness or something like that. It's not asking us to pretend that pleasant things are unpleasant and that we have to turn away. Instead, it's asking us to see clearly. Can we see clearly what objects and experiences can provide and what they can't provide? And we have a whole entire ginormous industries that are trying to tell you, buy this and you will be happy. Buy this and everybody will love you. Or, you know, maybe like some of our political figures, dislike or hate those other people over there, and then you'll always feel safe. Or, you know, make sure that you do what these people over here are doing, and then you will always be something protected. You'll feel safe or something like this, right? So there is so much that's trying to tell us what things can provide. But that's just the way that we created our economy and our political systems. And so the Dharma is asking us to look for ourselves, to see clearly, what do things provide? And so, how can we do this? How can we see clearly? Part of it is mindfulness. This is what mindfulness practice is so much about. We can appreciate that sometimes we sit together for 30 minutes and we have our anchor on the breath, for example, and the mind wanders and we just come back to the breath. And we're just doing this again and again. And it feels like maybe it's soothing, comforting, there's some settledness, a little bit of well-being that arises. But as the mind starts to settle down more, we can see more and more clearly. When the mind isn't so distracted, we can start to see more and more clearly. And we can even start to see, oh yeah, you know what? I thought that this was going to provide the nourishment or the safety or the love or the belonging that I'm looking for. But maybe we're so distracted that we don't even really notice that it's not. And so there's this way that mindfulness practice can do two things. One, it could help us notice the seeking that we're doing that doesn't feel like it's ever getting satisfied. Because often we're distracting ourselves from that. But mindfulness can also show, oh yeah, this object, I had these expectations. It was going to be a lasting source of happiness. It made me happy for a little while, but it's not lasting. So that mindfulness can help us see clearly both our own experience of feeling undernourished and the failure of these things that we're pursuing to give us what we're looking for. And then when we start to see that, it's not like we have to force ourselves to turn away. It's kind of like this dog with the bone. The dog is like chewing, seeking. And then it just realizes, okay, mom, there's not what I'm looking for is not here. And it just turns away. So we don't have to force ourselves. We just have to be willing to see clearly. We just have to be willing to feel the disappointment, like, wow, I thought this was going to make me feel happy. And maybe it did for a short moment. So it's not asking us to, abandon things. Instead, it's just asking us to be present for our experience. And sometimes when we realize, oh, this isn't going to be a lasting source of happiness like I thought it was, there can be some sense of loss, some sense of grief, some sense of confusion. And this was the case for me when I left my corporate America job. I did feel a little bit confused afterwards and with a sense of loss, like, wow, well, now what do I do? Now, who am I? What value do I have in the world? How do I be in the world? It was uncomfortable. It was not easy, right? To see this and to make a change and to decide to do something different. But this discomfort, it's often what precedes this greater freedom. When we start to see, oh yeah, how our identities get tied up with our professions, get tied up with having success or being seen a particular way. There's this sense of relief when we realize, oh yeah, I don't have to keep this seeking in a way that I was doing before. I don't have to repeatedly ask my job to make me happy. Maybe it's unfortunate that I had to leave before I could find that out. Maybe if I had more skill and wisdom at the time, I could have stayed and figured that out. For me, I wasn't able to. I kind of had to step away. But I know some people who have been able to just have a big shift in their relationship with their professional life, with their family life, their married life, whatever it is. not feeling like they had to abandon everything. This disenchantment is about just recognizing, okay, what can it provide and what can it not provide? Gaining some clarity about it. So, rather than forcing ourselves to letting go, with mindfulness we can recognize what's happening and we can do some investigation. We can kind of like actively being a little query. When we find ourselves kind of like the sense of hitting our head against the wall kind of experience, we can ask ourselves, what is being promised here? And what does it actually provide? And how long does this satisfaction that I'm getting, how long does it last? And what is the cost of chasing this? We can just ask ourselves these questions. Maybe this is done with having a conversation with somebody, hanging out with a cup of coffee, talking about it. Maybe it's a whole text exchange that happens for a while. Maybe it's a phone call. Maybe it's a journal prompts that we do. What is being promised and does it actually give what it's going to promise? And how long does this satisfaction last? And what's the cost of all this seeking? Maybe this is in meditation. This is not meant to be a self-criticism. This is not about saying like, oh, look, you thought it was going to do this and then it doesn't deliver. There can be a way in which the inner critic shows up and says, what are you doing? You should have known better. No. This is about compassion. This is about helping us find more freedom. This is about us finding what we really want. What we really want. Because something happens when we stop demanding that experiences and objects start satisfying us in this real deep way. When we stop demanding that or stop asking that, then objects and experiences can simply be themselves. And it's amazing how delightful they can be. When we are stop asking them to be different, when we stop trying to get water from a stone, we can just appreciate the stone. How beautiful it is. What kind of is it? Why is it different size than all the others? Why is it here? And maybe it's great to sit on if it's a big stone, or maybe it's a little stone that you can paint on and with hearts and give to somebody, or, you know, the stone can get turned back into a stone instead of trying to be something that delivers water or blood or whatever it is. I can't remember what the expression is. Water from a stone, blood from a stone, it was something that's non-stoney from a stone. So disenchantment, this turning away this from what is not satisfying. This, in the suttas, this shows up as a critical part of liberation. It's a step on the way to liberation. In the Upanisa Sutta, it shows up after it's in like part of this long chain of events that just naturally arise. Part of this, there's 12 steps in the whole thing. I'll just start with the last ones. Concentration, a certain amount of settledness, allows seeing things as they really are. I talked about them, seeing them, that they don't provide what we're wanting them to provide. But it could also be something more universal, like, wow, everything is impermanent and changing. And when we see that, we realize, oh, of course, this idea of lasting satisfaction can't exist because there's nothing that's lasting in the way that we want it to be or expect it to be. Then after seeing things as they are, Yate Buddha Jnana Dasana. Knowledge and vision of things as they are is often how it's translated. Then will be Nibbida, disenchantment. And then Viraga, dispassion. This no longer getting as tangled up with things. And then liberation. So this disenchantment is an integral part on this way to more and more freedom. It might feel like, oh, this is going to make everything dull if I like get rid of all these spells I'm under. But it turns out to be this beautiful way in which there's more ease, there's more freedom, there's more, things are more alive when we allow them to be what they are, experiences and objects. And not only do things become more alive or beautiful or something that they maybe have a little more of a sparkling quality, but not only that, the heart and the mind are no longer so tired, exhausted, trying to get water from a stone, trying to get meat from a bone. And it becomes more available to care for others, to care for ourselves, to make a difference in this world, to make the world the way that we want it to be the change that we want to be. We have more capacity for that. We can make a difference for ourselves, for people we love, maybe for people that we don't even know. So the path of practice is asking us to look. What am I hoping to find here with anything? Maybe start with the thing that's a pain point. Maybe start with something that's easy to maybe turn away from. What am I hoping to find here? And is this actually nourishing in a way that I would like it to be? And then if we discover that it isn't, the heart just naturally lets go. The heart just naturally turns away. We don't have to convince ourselves. We don't have to do it because that's what a good practitioner would do or something like that. In exactly the same way that the dog, when it discovers the bone can't deliver what it wants, it just turns away and goes elsewhere. The same is true for our hearts and minds. But we have to discover, we have to experience. It doesn't help that just to hear somebody tell you about it or just to read about it. You have to experience for yourself. And then the heart becomes maybe lighter or quieter, maybe more tender, more free. So disenchantment isn't the end of maybe the love for life or an appreciation for things. It's not saying that we can't have anything delightful. Disenchantment is the end of asking life to provide what it can't provide, what only actually more freedom can provide. The more and more freedom that we have, the more and more we're asking the world to give us what it can't give. And this freedom comes from seeing things as they are and just allowing the letting go to happen. And it's this letting go that leads to the freedom. It's not something we force. It's not something that we demand. It's kind of like this natural cascade that arises. So when the heart, when the mind stops seeking in those places that can't deliver what we're really looking for, then it becomes not only free, but available for whatever's arising next. Available to love others, love ourselves, love life. So disenchantment, maybe it doesn't sound so inspiring, but it turns out to be such a key thing that can make a big difference in our life. And with that, I'll end and open it up to see if there's some comments or questions. Thank you.
Is suffering like the only way that one can get interested in the Dharma? Or if someone is like having a great time, so much pleasure, not suffering, can they somehow turn to the Dharma? Or is suffering usually the gateway?
So this is my experience, what I have seen. There's kind of like two gateways. One is suffering. The other is people have experiences. Some people, like in the midst of a car accident, somebody was telling me how, like, while as the car was slipping over and over and over, they kind of like saw, I don't know, they had this experience like, wow, life is not the way I thought it was. Or some people do psychedelics or something like this, or they, yeah. So they have extreme experiences and they touch into something that they like, yeah, that felt more real than my whole life. And they want to explore it. So that's what my experience has been, suffering or having an experience that they want to understand better or touch into again. Just having nonstop pleasure. I haven't heard about this. I'm not sure anybody has nonstop pleasure though.
No, I know. I mean, just like someone's having a great time, a movie star, a rock star, and they don't think anything wrong with their life. And without that experience, that suffering, could they somehow just like, oh, you know, have that moment without either of those two experiences?
I don't know anybody who has, let me say that. And then I'll just say, I personally think that rock stars and movie stars have miserable lives.
But I mean, they might not think so.
I don't know. I don't know. And the only thing that I know is what the media is feeding us. So I don't actually know. So
I was thinking when you talked about the dog, that was a really smart dog to turn away. As I was thinking of a few bones I chew on, and I know they're not satisfying. I'm seeing somewhat clearly, but I guess not clearly enough to be ready yet to turn away.
Yeah, so part of the way to, and this is uncomfortable, is to actually feel the ugh of, like, I've been chewing on this for a long time, and it's not giving me what I want, or what's not deeply satisfying. And that is uncomfortable. And the second thing, it's uncomfortable to, A, like, I've been doing this for a long time, it's not going to work, but what else am I going to do? Mm-hmm. That kind of feeling of that there's a little bit of disorientation or, oh, what's the alternative? That's also uncomfortable. So I just want to say this too.
And it seemed like in this other aspect of my life, I used the words, it's sort of this habit I had, it sort of lost its charm. Kind of naturally, so disenchantment, I guess.
Yeah.
But that one, you know, seemed to be just easier, you know, just naturally. I'm like, oh, yeah, this really isn't bringing me much true contentment. Yeah.
And so that's great that you saw this. You could see this. And it lost its charm. I love that disenchantment. Thank you, Lena.
So what makes What makes the enchanting? What is the magician that makes it so enchanting? Like, what's their tricks, or is that just is there some response to that?
It's interesting that you're asking that, because sometimes we would say disenchantment is seeing when the magician's tricks. Like, once you see that how the magician does a trick, then it's not so interesting anymore, and you just naturally turn away. But your question is, why do we think that these things will bring us the nourishment or whatever we're looking for? Is that your question?
Yeah, like, why do we see them that way?
Why do we see them that way? I think this is the human condition. I think this is part of what it means to be human. And it's not easy to, and certainly we've created, certainly I would say in the modern West, that really is, we're just bombarded with messages to do the opposite of what I'm talking about here. Yeah, but Daniel, I don't know why. I don't even know if there is why. I'm just wondering, is why even the right question? I mean, it's a valid question, but maybe that's not a way. If we knew that, then we could maybe stop it, I guess, is what you're thinking is, right? If we understood.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think this is probably evolutionary biology has some role in there and this type of thing. So, thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
First and foremost, thank you so much for the talk. It definitely resonated. You know, just like, I guess going back to the metaphor of the dog and chewing of the bone, how might you bridge, like, what if, like, all your life you're chewing on this bone, you've been conditioned to chew on a bone, and at some point you've realized, or maybe other people have maybe realized, or maybe through, like, meditation, you've, like, surfaced that chewing on this bone doesn't necessarily give you that, like, contentment anymore. But then because of perhaps, like, the habit of, like, chewing on that bone, it's almost so hard to, like, rewire yourself. And you only really know, oh, that wasn't satisfying, like, a few seconds or a few days after you're done chewing on that bone, if that makes sense. So, like, how does one maybe connect the practice of insight, or I guess I connect insight with, like, the practice of, like, okay, bone, you're not my thing anymore, and I'll find something else.
Mm-hmm. One of the most effective ways is to really feel the disappointment. Like, oh, I spent all this time, and I have this momentum, I've been doing this for, and just allow yourself to feel it. Don't tip into overwhelm or anything like this. But then you just like, oh, I don't want to feel that anymore. But so often we're distracting ourselves from that. Like, oh yeah, I shouldn't be doing that. And then we just quickly go do something else. So this is where the Dharma is asking us to see clearly. Maybe I should say to feel clearly. Feel the disappointment. So I would say that's one. Actually, allow yourself to really feel it. Two is to respect the momentum that life has. I mean, just like, oh yeah, okay, I don't like this. It makes me feel uncomfortable. Wow, look at this. I'm doing it again. And then you can feel the discomfort of that. But also recognize, yeah, okay, this isn't something that's going to end quickly. How could it end quickly if I've been doing it all this time? But maybe there's so many things we can do with change habits and let go of habits or something like this. But I don't want to say that this is going to be easy, fast, or comfortable. It is life-changing. It is deeply meaningful. It's deeply satisfying. It's what we're looking for.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you for your kind attention. Wishing you a wonderful rest of the evening and safe travels home. Thank you.